Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm your host this week, Jesse Billington, and we're back to review the 16th round of the 2025 Formula One season, the Italian Grand Prix. To do this, I'm joined by Timo Albus Daly. How are you?
Not badly, Mr. Billington. We had the fastest Grand Prix in history, and there's not too much to report from it. There's the big elephant in the room, of course, but aside from that, it was sort of the antidote that we needed after Zandvoort. I was saying in our preview that I didn't want it necessarily to be as dull as China in terms of Australia to China as the vast difference between them. We definitely didn't get that, but we weren't a million miles away either, which is quite surprising from Monza. I think potentially one of the, I hesitate to say the word dullest, but least dramatic Italian Grand Prix we've had in quite a long time. I mean, maybe with the exception of 2023, but if you don't count that, I can't remember the last time we had a truly kind of, and I'm trying not to use negative words, but, you know, non-thrilling Italian Grand Prix.
Just a straightforward Grand Prix, a relatively sort of conventional one by all regards. Yeah, it was a good sort of flip of the coin compared to the chaos of Zandvoort. We just had sort of a straightforward motor race, and I think the monkey's paw curls one more digit as obviously Stefano Domenicali gets his reward for shorter races by having one that sort of 73 minutes all in or something ridiculous like that. It was one of the fastest.
I was looking at the clock a couple of times and going, bloody hell, we really are, short of something happening, going to be done relatively quickly, and I've got plans for later in the day, and now I've got more time before them than I thought. I'm like, well, what am I doing? I didn't plan to have this much extra time available to me. What am I doing with this?
Yeah, you've got this sort of weird gap open up in your afternoon where you go, there's usually an hour of something else happening here, but that's what it is. But yes, we'll move on into the Grand Prix. We'll kick off with a bit of news first. And the first bit is Formula One calendar news. Istanbul, Hockenheimring and Portimao are all in negotiations to rejoin the F1 calendar. Now, obviously, at the moment, this is early negotiations. We don't know whether this would be as part of a rotating deal with another circuit, because we've already got a few of those starting to appear, or if they would have a full-term contract that would see them here for a couple of years back to back. And I'm excited for all three of those, because they're all good circuits that produce some good racing. Hockenheimring is one of those sort of classics, a proper old school motor racing circuit akin to the likes of Silverstone and Monza. Portimao, we know from our sort of brief visits there during the COVID era that it can produce a fairly exciting race, because it's got those great elevation changes that do throw different loads across the car, forcing drivers to think differently. And Istanbul is always a bit of a firecracker, especially if they've sort of resurfaced it with butter again for some reason.
I mean, in my opinion, Istanbul should never have left the F1 calendar. It's a phenomenal track, and for so many different reasons. And yeah, with or without butter, it's a great track to go racing at. And you've got so many, I don't use the word too lightly, iconic moments from over the time that F1 raced there. So that one I'm definitely on board. And I don't mind about Hockenheim or Portimao either. I mean, I think both are better than Zandvoort and Imola. So if they replace those, then we've got an upgrade in my opinion. Hockenheim, we've had some more crazy races in recent history. In Portimao, I'll disagree slightly in terms of the good racing. It's not been bad, but I think it's more of a unique visual element to it. It's a little bit like Zandvoort in that way of, we go up and down and up and down and we're a bit different. But it's not had bad races. So I think that's the key thing there. And I wouldn't mind going back there. It's not where, you know, you'd see Zandvoort and Imola getting renewed, for example. I'm going, even with F2 and F3, I'm not too thrilled for it. The races for those haven't been so great. And if with these giant cars, and even though next year's are slightly smaller, I'm not too up for it. Whereas the other two, I'm like, we've not really seen too much with that. So I'm at least up for trying it once every couple of years if the rotation comes into it.
It'll be interesting to see. And I think, yeah, you're right with Portimao on the fact that it's a bit like Zandvoort in that it's visually distinct, but I think it would also produce, a bit like we're sort of going to get into discussions with, a clean and technical Grand Prix, not necessarily one that's packed with chaos, but one that possibly invites good and close racing. Speaking of the calendar, Monaco has received a extension to 2035. Its previous contract saw it on the calendar as far as 2031. But as I saw one person joking, there could be a nuclear apocalypse and Monaco would still be on the calendar.
Bit like Istanbul, but with the permanence that Istanbul doesn't have, it should never leave the calendar. So the extension is the only acceptable thing to do.
Especially if we're getting these smaller cars, it could be very exciting. And again, Formula 2, Formula 3 there is always good fun to enjoy. Meanwhile, speaking of contract extensions, Pierre Gasly is clearly suffering Stockholm syndrome as he has signed an extension at Alpine to the end of 2028. This is a fairly long old contract. And yeah, I assume he thinks there's going to be something interesting coming in these new regulations for Alpine.
He's a brave man. I think his only hope is at the moment that they do a sort of Williams 2014 style job next year. And I don't know what else the motivation could be there because, I keep saying that I find their livery this year to be a cracking one, but I don't think that's enough of a reason to sign up for an extra few years at the F1 team. And yeah, I'm very intrigued. And he says he believes in the project and all the correct party lines are being followed, but I do wonder what goodies come with the contract potentially and how many out clauses he has in there should he get the opportunity to go elsewhere.
Yeah, I think it's possibly a position that will be bolstered by the arrival of Audi, given the doubts there are around Audi's power unit when they arrive in the sport. So I think he's got a fair crack at sort of retaining a midfield position. I think there's enough that's going to be going on around him that's going to keep him bolstered. The only thing I will say is that potentially is a bit of an outlier this weekend is that Colapinto finally seems to be sort of getting his feet, not necessarily under the table, but certainly knows what he's doing with them when it comes to this season and the Alpine. He's sort of a bit closer on performance. It's still not producing any points, mind, but he's not put it in the wall this
Remind me of that when we talk about Alpine later, because otherwise I'm going to skip to the end of our team by team analysis. But I had some thoughts on that. But one of the amusing things I will just say on that point is that Natalie Binkman was talking to Flavio Briatore pre-race, and she was asking him, "Is this year a bit of a I think a rebuild year for Alpine before you get going next year?" And he was doing his classic Flavio thing. But I just thought. Has every year recently not been a rebuild year for Alpine? Is this not just them going, "We have a 100-race plan," and you go, "Yeah, we've heard that one before, and we've heard that one before," and we keep hearing it. Look, when do you plan on actually get going at some point? Because if you keep rebuilding at some point, like how far down are you going? Maybe you should have gone down to the foundations to begin with, because I don't see what there's left to rebuild at this point because you supposedly have done everything.
Yeah, it's questions still hang over that team, but we'll get to that in a minute. But first, we'll get through the quickest Formula One Grand Prix in history, and we'll kick off with the team that we really thought would be leading the charge this weekend, McLaren. Piastri qualified third, Norris qualified second, and that's how they came home. And there's good reason that that's how they came home in that order, I think. Well, there is certainly a reason why they came home in that order.
Max Verstappen, certainly. But
Yeah,
yes, in that specific
well.
order, yes. Such a. You thought Budapest last year, which they even made reference to themselves, was going to be sort of the pinnacle of the silliness that played there, and they'd learn from that and move on. But so no. Why do that? And I think I saw someone comment over the day yesterday that McLaren are really giving Ferrari a run for their money at the moment in terms of their decision making and all that good stuff. And the way I look at it is, first on Saturday, Piastri had to help his more experienced teammate and championship rival get into Q3. Norris was struggling a bit in qualifying. He was doing well in practice, but then he was struggling, and that was already interesting enough in itself and shows that they've got some good team harmony. And in qualifying, I can maybe understand that because you want to. Maybe for the sake of fairness and sportsmanship, have a level kind of fight there. Kind of on board with that, but still interesting that it needed to be done in the first place. Then we have the Grand Prix, which, as we know, was relatively bland and straightforward. Nothing too untoward happened. And then Norris is suddenly given this option to pit first, which is his right as the lead driver at that point, but he declines. So why then, when Norris goes long in his own pit box and the front left gun doesn't work properly, should Piastri be the one that has to pay for the consequences for the risk that Norris took? Obviously, I'm not blaming Norris for all of this because what could he do about the gun? What, he made the decision, but he had no control of the gun. He had no control over what the team was then going to do. But why not just let them race it out? championships aren't won or lost in a single moment, but well, that's also something that someone really should tell Felipe Massa, but that's another thing. But there's a collection of moments that make up how you lose a championship, and Piastri letting Norris through was a big mistake that could prove cost, I think, and it was unnecessary. And Verstappen's team radio summed it up really well, I thought. Just the cackling laughter of why on earth would you do that to your main championship rivaling teammate, essentially. He wouldn't do it. Hamilton, Vettel, Rosberg, Raikkonen, Alonso, even Webber, I don't think, would have done that, regardless of what maybe the latter might say on that publicly, considering he's Oscar's manager. But I just thought if you're going to let them race, that's one thing, that's fine. But then why not just then let them race? If Norris is quicker or wants to get ahead of Piastri, go and overtake him then. Don't let it's not the same as Budapest last year. That was a case of supposedly Norris was in a championship fight. You can understand the frustration from him there, but Piastri had been leading the whole time, and you know, they're still finding their feet. This year, though, they're the only two in this championship fight, realistically. There's no reason for them to help each other. Beating your teammate is the prerogative of every team in Formula One. That's your main rival there, regardless of whatever else is going on. And I just don't understand it. It seems so bizarre, and I feel like it's maybe a little bit of guilt from the team from last weekend because they, as a team, technically let down Lando because the car went kaboom. But that doesn't mean you should compromise Oscar for that. So very frustrating, very mind-boggling. And the fact that then Oscar, he said what he said, and then he let him go through anyway, I thought it's very sportsmanlike, but the wrong move, in my opinion.
Yeah, they pitted Oscar first because they wanted to protect Oscar from Leclerc, who was closing at about half a second a lap, but they still had loads of time to do that. They could have pitted Norris first, but McLaren made that
Well, they
call.
gave him the choice and he
Yeah.
went. As long as there's no undercuts, it's fine.
Yeah. And they both drivers sort of called it fair with the information they were handed by the team. Obviously, at that point in time, the team have all the data to hand. They have the ability to make a far more informed call, and what they choose to inform the drivers about is their prerogative, and then leave the drivers to make the decision. So that was why they pitted Piastri first. And again, it's one of those things of it's chaos theory. You never know if you do it the other way around, whether or not you're going to have gun failure, if Norris is going to miss the stop box, all those things. So it's Yeah, there's a lot of ifs that surround it, as always seems to be the case when it comes to Lando and certainly McLaren as well at the moment. But I think Oscar potentially played a very clever long game here because he's now got essentially a favour owed by the team. I think Hungary last year is now long forgotten. That's all been paid back. That's all come out in the wash. But Piastri long term has the upper hand because there's going to come a point where he needs a tow, he needs a better pit strategy, he needs a decision like this that will almost certainly come up because it seems to happen more and more often these days. He's now got that in his pocket as a favour. And I think that that's possibly a very clever long game because all he's done here is lose out 3 points out of a very big lead. Don't call it six if you allow for the swing, but it's net gain. It's a 3 point difference to where they were at going into this Grand Prix. And Piastri's pot now possibly got sort of a little added just moment where he needs to pressure the team into making a call that goes his way. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out when it comes to actually sort of making the swap and sort of McLaren asking to do it. Norris had far more pace across the weekend than Piastri did. I think Norris was coming past regardless. They didn't have to make Piastri let him pass. I think
But
that
then why not just let him get past?
because McLaren are so risk averse at the moment, they're standing in the great position where if they have a strong result in Azerbaijan, they win the Constructors' Championship dead early.
Risk averse. I will. Yeah, that's perfectly fine. But at the same time, the real chances are they're not going to balls this championship up constructors wise so badly that they lose it. So does it matter if it's Baku, Singapore, or Austin? Realistically, no.
Ultimately,
So why be
both.
so risk averse that, and also that just shows a lack of trust in the two drivers. Because if you're going, well, we could let you race as we keep claiming we're going to let you do, and then as soon as we given the opportunity to let you race properly, no, Oscar, let Lando through, and it's like Budapest from last year. And I get the point you make with the the long-term potentially strategic call from Oscar there and why that could be an advantage, but that does also rely then on the team still being uniform in their decision making at that point, honoring these things. Zac Brown, regardless of what he may say, is more of a Lando kind of fan, shall we say, than Oscar. It's his essentially adopted son, and he will try and give him every advantage possible. And I wouldn't be surprised if Oscar can need a favor at some point from McLaren, and it isn't given to him. And if he loses the championship by 3 or 6 points, like I say, these championships aren't won or lost in a single moment, but he's going to look back on Monza and go, and think, just my train of thoughts, so I'll continue there for a second.
No, it's going to be one of those ones that we won't know the true implications and ramifications of it of until it all plays out, until the season comes to an end and we know where they stand.
If
But I think,
he wins, it looks great, you know,
yeah.
overall. He's done the right thing morally, ethically, all that lovely la-di-da stuff. But if it's unnecessarily close, or if he loses, everyone's going to point straight at that, barring nothing else too major happening, going, that right there is what caused this. And it's just very frustrating because you just think it's part of racing. Like you say, there's a lot of ifs and buts of what could have happened if things had been reversed. But yeah, that's the luck of the draw. That's racing. That's hit Lando's car blowing up last week. Sometimes you have bad luck. It just happens to be on Lando this time. So deal with it. And if he's quicker anyway on the pace, like you were saying, then why not just go and overtake him? Monza, you can overtake a plenty there in these cars. Just go and do it.
Yeah.
You're not a threat from behind from Leclerc. You're not going to go catch Max up ahead. Trust your two drivers. They must have learned from Austria. They must have learned from Canada. There's no need. They're not fighting for anything massive in this particular Grand Prix. It's not for the win. So why not just let them do that? Instead, you're given this weird Budapest sequel where everyone's just incredibly frustrated with you after going, what did we tell you last time you did something stupid like that?
I think it is. I think that's what it comes to, is they're so risk averse they don't want to sort of let them race. And I don't like how
I don't
that,
understand it.
I don't understand it. The whole point is we go motor racing, as that sort of famous line often comes out. And yeah, it just leaves you feeling a bit flat. But we'll move on from McLaren, otherwise we could be here till the cows come home talking about it. We'll move to the interesting case of Ferrari. Hamilton qualified fifth, started 10th on the grid after taking his 5-place grid penalty from Zandvoort, would go on to finish sixth. Leclerc qualified fourth and finished fourth.
Great fight from Leclerc early doors, it's got to be said. And again, I think this Grand Prix highlights a couple of things about this regulation set perfectly, one of which being if nothing really goes wrong, it's quite forgettable in terms of a Grand Prix. If it wasn't for McLaren doing their thing, we probably wouldn't be talking that much about this race in general. And I think the second thing is that Russell showed this as well. You can stay close to the car in front. So technically, we're getting that closer racing we were promised ahead of 2022. But in terms of that doing anything, not much of anything at all.
The problem
And
Russell had there, I will say, is that the Mercedes engine just didn't have the outright speed and performance to get close to the Ferraris. If you look at the outright speed of even the McLarens, they were what their main concern, they said, going into the weekend was the Ferraris. And that was proven correct. If you looked at the speed trap results, every car that was topping out through sort of north of 220, we saw the Ferraris doing 225 mile an hour.
it was all
It's
Ferrari in
all
the end.
Ferrari powered engine cars. It was just an advantage that came down to power unit when it came to George getting close. But I feel that's an important caveat.
But at the same time, regardless of that, you can still get close, but you can't do anything with any of it, regardless of if you've got the engine capability or not. So frustrating on that sense, and frustrating as well that Hamilton had that and already carried over, because I think him and Leclerc potentially tag teaming the McLarens could have been interesting, even if it didn't work out long term. It would have at least given us something interesting to watch and talk about. I thought that it was a brilliant move through the field by Hamilton early on in the race, and proof that had he started with Leclerc, they could have then gone on a bit further, maybe, and snatched a podium for one of them at least, and given McLaren a bit of a headache. Because I think once Max was past Lando for the second time, that was never going to be on, really. So if they could have worked as a way to try and at least get one of the McLarens and get on the podium at the home race, that would have been Excellent form, as Percy was saying. We will take a potion. We won't be getting too ahead of ourselves here. They weren't doing what I was doing in the predictions going. We're going to get a 1-2, guys. Don't worry about it. But another bit of a what if for them. But I think the livery was still beautiful on track. You've got Jackie Ickx in his old Ferrari. And yeah, I think in terms of Ferrari, they did the maximum that they could, which is still weirdly enough to get them into P2 overall in the constructors and keep them there. So I guess I'm both a glass half full and half empty with them this year, and I am the contradiction that that brings with it.
Yeah, it was a great performance from Leclerc, sort of that opening joss. And I think it's worth mentioning Hamilton as well. He didn't have a great start. He got swallowed up in the pack, as you often run the risk of doing in that midfield when the toe is so great coming off the line. But then his fight back, really sort of stomping his way through the field and making some decisive moves. He's seemed a lot more at home with the car this weekend. And again, I think it's important to also note that this was not a circuit that was going to throw up that flaw that Ferrari has with its floor, essentially. They had the car at the right ride height. They were able to have sort of tires that were in a constant working window, and they got away with it. So there's two sides to that coin. But I think overall for Ferrari, this is a good weekend, and one again they can walk away from this quite happy, because they had sort of both their drivers close together in a strong points position. When you look at the spread of their nearest rivals of Mercedes and Red Bull, very different outcome.
But I think as well, had McLaren let their drivers race and had something happened, they were perfectly positioned for at least one of the cars to take advantage. And say there'd been 10 laps or so, or 5 laps even, of a race restart at the end of the Grand Prix, and the whole field is bunched up, a chance at the win, a chance to get both cars on the podium if Hamilton could have got past Russell. So they did what teams in their position and in the midfield should do at the bottom end of the top 10 and be kind of placed strategically enough to work going. We're not probably going to get points today, but if we can get into 11 and 12, maybe if something happens, we're perfectly in position for it. And they did the top team version of that. And yeah, they got the maximum of what they could on potential. And then if opportunities came their way, they were perfectly primed for that. And I think as a team, that's probably the best you can ask for if you can't go out right and go any further than where you are.
Yeah, they capitalized on the weekend and sort of made the most of it. I don't think there's a lot really to say about Ferrari beyond that. They're in the
We're
right place.
strangely happy with them,
Yeah, there's nothing to be
all things
critical
considered.
about. They got the most out of what they could have done this weekend. I think the only other thing they could have really done was have perhaps Hamilton come home fifth. But again, that's a bigger ask considering he started further back, and we're sort of restricted by what we can get on this series of regulations. Next, though, is Mercedes. Russell qualified fifth, finished fifth. Antonelli qualified sixth and slipped backwards to finish ninth.
Not much to say on Russell, really. He was just dicey, had some great scraps, and did what George Russell does. I thought there's not really too much to say on him, which I'll be amazed. Maybe we can work it out at the end of the season how much airtime we've actually spent talking about him throughout the season. I'll be amazed if it comes up to like more than 20 minutes, if that.
Yeah.
I was going to say 10, maybe. I was like, maybe 10 minutes we spent talking about him, but no more than 20 certainly. Antonelli. Interesting. His penalty seemed odd, but that's also the stewards for you lately. He had a bad start as well, and when you combine that with the penalty, he was quite lucky to get P9 in the end. And yeah, amusingly enough, in the sadistic way, Italian Grand Prix aren't going well for him so far. An interesting stat that came out, which I again, stats that you didn't realize were stats until you heard them. I don't know if you came across this one, but before the weekend, Antonelli was the first Mercedes driver to not make it to Q3 for three or more races in a row since Rosberg back in 2012. Just to show you how interesting his season is going there. But yeah, I thought the penalty for being too erratic was taking the pits ever so slightly. I don't know. I mean, I've got a lot of issues with the stewards last weekend and this weekend, and this is the first example we've come across for them. So, what did you think on that one?
He was making some odd moves and some moves that really shouldn't have been sort of attempted, I think, was the thing for me with Kimi. There were moments where I'm going, I don't know why you're doing that. You're just jeopardizing too much. So I can see why the stewards potentially sort of came to honor him for being erratic. But the problem is, when you're looking at what the stewards got up to this weekend, I think we'll get to it and we
What are
get.
the drivers? Yeah, it seems like if you're giving this to one driver for one thing, why is this? Why is it the equivalent to something else we've seen? And why is it different from what we've seen with a different driver? And I think that's where
Yeah, the
the
Antonelli thing
problems come in.
feels out of proportion considering something else that happened in the race and the result that it generated. Yeah, Russell, I don't know. I think we're barely at 20, how many races are there this season? There's 24 races. If we talk about him for 2 minutes at each of those, okay, maybe we get to 40 minutes of Russell. I think this
But
across.
most of it, at least half of it, will be saying there's not much to say about him
Yeah, well, if you think
because
we've
he's
got
just gone and done George Russell things.
40 minutes of talking about George Russell, I'm fairly certain on one podcast alone, we did half an hour on Red Bull just on one segment. So
Yeah,
there's your contrast.
minimum one episode
Yeah,
of
on just
we've done
one
multiple
episode.
episodes of
Yeah.
those, so yeah.
And that's the thing, Russell is just having one of those seasons that's like, this is like, I don't know how, let me have a quick
It's
check.
Leclerc last year. He's
Yeah.
just bang, bang, bang.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. 14, 15. Out of the all the race meetings we've had so far, this is his 15th top five finish. That includes all the sprints. So we've had what, one, two, three sprints. Three sprints, and what did I say? We're on the 15th round.
16 Grand Prix,
So
and
we're
he's
on,
gone and been in 15 of them.
yeah, so what's that? Three sprints and 16 rounds is 19 races, and he 15 out of the 19 rounds, he's finishing in the top 10, in the top five, sorry. And then there's a few where he's still finishing in the top 10. So we're like, this is consistency that's incredible. And I think this is what's keeping him in such an interesting little sort of, I wouldn't say championship fight as such, because he's a fair way adrift of Verstappen at the moment, but he's also a good way ahead of Leclerc. He's on what, 194? Leclerc's on 163 at the moment, as it stands. I think that's huge. I think
And I think Verstappen and Russell perfectly demonstrate how Ferrari, as a constructor, are ahead of them, both in the standings, but why these drivers individually are ahead of both Ferrari drivers. It does make sense, even though it makes your brain go, I don't understand, because it does make sense.
yeah, Ferrari have got a medium level consistency across both their drivers, which is better than good consistency from one driver per team. And the result is it's teamwork, it doubles up, and so on and so forth. But yeah, it's just one of those things where you sort of look at it and go, oh, I don't know how he's done it, but it just makes sense. And I think ultimately for Russell, he can walk away from the season, which will probably be one of his best. I don't know what his highest championship result is across a year. I'd be curious to
Say
have
the rate he's going, it's got to be this year.
yeah. Let's see. Do, 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 do. 2024, he finished in sixth. I don't know that off the top of my head. Let's see. 2022, he finished fourth. So he could tie with 2022 for his best season yet, which would be very interesting.
It's a shame Max is winning as much as he is, otherwise that would be a much closer fight and he could maybe snatch that P3 from him.
We'll see how the championship trundles on. Speaking of Max, we'll get to Red Bull then. Qualified on pole with the fastest qualifying lap around Monza. Finished
Fastest lap in F1 history.
last lap in F1 history. Yeah, outstanding stuff. And then goes on to take the win by a 20-second margin. For a brief moment, I thought we were watching 2023 again. I was like, ooh, that's astonishing.
You and a lot of other people. It
Yeah.
was, I don't know if you heard Bortoletto's team radio afterwards, but he was told that Verstappen won and went, whoa, no way, that's mad. And I just thought, imagine that 2 years ago, thinking that
No.
that's a mad thing, first of all, but also, yeah, it is kind of mad.
Yeah, if it was 2 years ago, that would be award for most sarcastic team radio. But yeah, Tsunoda, a slightly better weekend, at least on the Saturday, qualifying in the Q3, came home Q9 in ninth. Obviously, that allows for Hamilton's penalty, and would finish 13th. Just messy from Tsunoda, I think, at points.
Yeah, I'll do Verstappen first. A lot easier, just clinical Max from the days of old, as we talked about there. No notes really. I mean, a little bit of a cheeky move straight away, but at the same time, seeing how he then just swooped past Lando, and again, it's I won't go too much into this again now, but it's an amusing thing of Lando saying how Well, she's up for fighting Max and all this sort of thing. But then whenever he gets the opportunity, it looks like the easiest cakewalk for Max in the park. And Matt is saying something into drink. Some of the other drones, he just obviously goes past quite easily. We've not seen anything from Lando yet, though. We've seen from glimpses of Oscar v. Mac and Nelly v. Max in Bahrain, for example, and obviously Charles and Max and Lewis and Max. So that amused me, first of all. And then his team radio at the end of the Grand Prix spoke volumes for such a short message. Better qualifying from Tsunoda, so clearly he listens to the podcast and was listening to us on that front. But yeah, an abysmal race. Hamilton and Albon being the biggest to beat him. Hamilton, perhaps not surprising. Albon, a little bit more so, but also less so at the same time. He got into a messy fight with Lawson too, who we'll talk about, but essentially had nothing to lose from going and fighting whoever was around him because his strategy was not working on any level. And as someone who we know races hard, I thought, and Tsunoda should really know that, considering how much time they spend together back at the factory and just generally because of Red Bull and everything, you'd think he'd know that a bit more. So would not be taking caution or be taking precautions rather, but would just be more aware of how to deal with someone like Lawson and wasn't, essentially. So again, disappointing in falls into 13th, and on a day when your teammate wins by over 20 seconds. Yes, I know it's Max Verstappen, but it just doesn't look good for you at all.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's the poison chalice because you never look good against your teammate when your teammate is Max Verstappen. And I mean, think about how many years we had that with sort of Nico Rosberg when he'd have like an off weekend, and all of a sudden against Hamilton, doubt came in. The same with Bottas as well, to a
But at
certain
the same
extent.
time, Bottas and Rosberg and Perez, if we take the Red Bull example, and Ricciardo with Red Bull when he was there, they still won Grand Prix. They still got on podiums. Yeah, they weren't there all the time, but they were still able to be up there. They were still able to do quite a bit with that second car.
It's
He hasn't.
yeah, Tsunoda just hasn't done it yet, and we're a fair way into the season. It's not like they swapped him at the summer break, they swapped him going into the third Grand Prix. So we're sort of 13 Grand Prix later and still struggling to see anything from him. It's difficult. Verstappen, I don't really have anything to say. This was an absolute masterclass from him.
Who does he think he is, George Russell?
Yeah, it does nothing wins. It's pure Verstappen in that aspect. And yeah, a bit scrappy with that opening lap incident, gave it back and then just fought his way back through perfectly fine. Standard back Max Verstappen fare. Tsunoda, we need to see something from him soon. And I
Well,
think,
he's running out of time any one way or the other. So yeah,
yeah.
sooner the better for him, for his own sake.
Better, sort of better for him, and also for Isaac Hadjar, who I think is possibly getting a bit worried that he's going to get the call up to that seat, whether he wants it or not, for 2026. And I don't think he wants it at the moment. He's got a podium in the RB.
I
He's
do
quite
have a get out
happy.
of jail free card for him, and it comes in the shape of Iwasa. You go leave Lawson and Hadjar and Lindblad where they all are. Maybe move Lindblad to Super Formula if you really want to do something, but just give him a second year in Formula 2. Let Lawson and Hadjar bed themselves in, get a bit more experience, really wring the neck of that racing bull. And for the sake of, we've not forgotten you, Ayuma, we promise, put him in the Red Bull, but also make that decision now. So that you can throw him in as many of the old cars as possible and give him all the time he needs. And then, he should be prepped, this unusual concept that Red Bull don't seem to have. And then give him a season. If he does well, great. If he doesn't, you've got two guys then that are maybe less apprehensive about being in that second seat. And it might go a bit better. And you've also got all the teething problems or a lot of the teething problems solved from the car for next year because no one's going to get it perfect straight away, I don't think. Cube, the most dominant season in F1 history that makes Red Bull 23 look minuscule, but there we go. And there you go, there's your eloquent solution.
Yeah, it's. I think the fact that there's new regulations coming next year is possibly the only chance Tsunoda has of keeping that seat, because they don't want to move up essentially a 1 year rookie into a completely untested car at the top team that's got huge expectations sat alongside Verstappen. So they might just sort of, for want of a better
Or
phrase.
you take a reassessment and go, we're not where we used to be. You kind of do what Mercedes didn't in 22 and go, we've got to reassess what the priorities are here. And that's why we're throwing Iwasa in. And we go, right, we've just got to, we're not quite 2005 levels of building up from the start, but we're going to, we're kind of, we've been taken down a notch. We're billionaires. We've had 10 billion. We've been knocked down to 2 billion. We're still pretty good, but we're going to have to just take a bit of humble pie and rebuild the empire slightly.
Yeah, there's it's an interesting one. I'd love to be a fly on the wall for those sort of meetings and discussions, but at the same time, thinking of it from a team wall, pit wall side of things, this is Laurent Mekhi's first win with Red Bull, obviously not long into that seat, and he sort of steered the team to a point where certainly at least half of the garage and one of the drivers is in a sort of confident place where they can really extricate the most from that car again. And possibly this is a sign that a bit of peace and tranquility is returning to that team, and we'll get to see the sort of Verstappen not necessarily join
Then I would add you keep Tsunoda as a third driver and you plug his brain into a computer, into a massive brain, transfer all the usable knowledge to help him as best as possible, because maybe the experience isn't helping, clearly. So
Yeah.
why not take the risk while you're not fighting for championships and see what it does? If it doesn't work, then always throw him back in.
I think there is, however, limits to how many drivers you're allowed into a car across the season. And I think there's some that Red Bull RB
Oh,
found
yeah, but next year, I
that.
mean.
Next year, maybe, yes. Yeah, next year they
Yeah, I'm
say.
not saying do it now. I'm saying you prep Iwasa as much as you can now with the eye of sticking him in the car next year, and you have Yuki talking to him and all the rest of it, but you keep him on the sidelines next year as a third driver in case you need to swap him out and it's really going bad. And you go, well, it can't get much worse, and then do it,
Put
and
a
then
humor
make an
in.
assessment at the end of the year.
Yeah, see where it goes. It's a baffling one. I don't think we're going to really know the answer to it. I think
I get the
ultimately,
thing I'm going to be frustrated regardless of what they do. This is not going to be anywhere near as sensible as it should
they're
be.
going to find like the 14th thing that we just didn't think of and go for that instead for some re option. They're going to go to like Singaporean F4 and find a Red Bull Junior driver from there and put him in. Anyway, we move from Red Bull to Williams, who are still in fifth place and sort of looking fairly comfortable in that sort of field with another points haul from Alex Albon. It looked good early on for Williams with great pace and quality in the free practice sessions. Qualifying didn't go their way. Albon 14th, Sainz 13th. But then they would go on to finish 7th and 11th, respectively, on the track. And yeah, Albon really had the pace in the Grand Prix. Sainz looked pacey at points as well, who then just started to get a bit messy towards the end. Obviously isn't a fan of how that car uses its tires later in the race and started to become a cropper of his own actions.
Yeah, it's Sainz is going to be worthy of a long conversation soon because we're past the point of saying it's just him getting used to the car because we're 16 Grand Prix in now and we're going, I'm not sure it's that now, so it must be something else. And his tangle with Behrmann says a lot. It's a little bit like Lawson last week. That and how he made zero effort, it seemed to take the escape road at T4 earlier on in the race. For me, just showed a lack of fundamentals again from him and a lot of frustration that he's got in that car and a lot of inconsistency. Great in practice, like you say, and then come qualifying, nowhere. And you'd think if anyone could then help get that car a bit further up into the top 10, especially when Tsunoda's fallen out and Alonso's fallen out, he should be there. And yet 11th, and you're going, nice, but you've got Carlos Sainz and Albon's in 7th. What's going on there? Brilliant stuff from Albon again in the race, despite the bad qualifying session, did not let that stop him. He just did what Alex Albon does, which is lovely to say. But Carlos Sainz, yeah, there's really something going on there. And this is the other bit where I got annoyed with the stewards, because for me, the Behrmann incident was just that. It was a bit of a racing incident. I think half a dozen one, half a dozen the other, Behrmann maybe shouldn't have been where he was, but at the same time, Carlos should have left him a bit of racing room. So for that to be Behrmann's fault and for him to get a 10-second penalty, and for that to be the equivalent penalty that Antonelli got for taking out Charles Leclerc last week is ridiculous. And then Sainz cutting T4. And with kind of like zero intention of doing anything differently. And he gets a reprimand for that. I mean, Martin Brundle said it perfectly in the commentary. Like, well, if I'm Lando or Oscar at the end of the race and it's getting a bit tight, sod it. I'm just going to cut across T4. I'll take a reprimand. Why wouldn't I do that then? That's the present you're sending, sending out for drivers. I'm surprised we didn't see that from someone else later on going, well, you look at what you did to science. Why shouldn't I do the exact same thing? And it's that that then compounds the rest of it, because you're seeing two mistakes from science here, principally, and no consequences. And you go, well, you didn't want to see him last week for whatever reason. They then went to try and sort it out this weekend. I'm not sure if they actually got in or not, or if they got any answers from the stewards. That bit wasn't totally clear. And then this all happens, and you go, it's just, like you said, messy and unnecessarily so. And what a difference 12 months makes for Carlos Sainz. And yeah, we've said it a couple of times already this season that Albon is maybe showing us what we were hoping for but didn't quite believe in, because Carlos Sainz is the force that he is. He's still the last driver to win a Grand Prix for Ferrari. He won multiple Grand Prix for them, and for him to be where he is at the moment is very mind-boggling, and not in a good way. Not in a Christopher Nolan, oh my God, what have I just watched kind of a way, more of a eh?
Yeah, it's the science one is baffling. I think the I'll start with the easiest point to address, which is the easiest point is Albon, fantastic. Keep doing what you're doing, sunshine. I think he's somewhere in the region of like this is 10 point finishes across the 16 Grand Prix we've had. So again,
Which, by the way, Carlos, with the exception of, I think, the Spa sprint race, hasn't scored points in Grand Prix since Canada as well. Let that sink in.
Yeah, Spa sprint. Then we go back to, yep, Canada, correct, was his last point scoring outing. And even then, it was a 10th, so it's hardly a stonker. But yeah, Albon, great. When it comes to Sainz, easiest one to address is that turn four, just sort of don't do it again, just sort of like a notification that they've clocked that you've done it. And I'm like, yeah, that's a strange precedent to set because if you're another driver that sort of knows you've got someone else closing into you, they're not necessarily close to you, but you know they've got
Oh
pace.
no, I've done an accident and I've just cut turn four. Sorry about that.
Cut it. Know that you're just sort of going to get slap knuckles for it. And there you are. You sort of opened up a 2 second gap again that you or added 2 seconds to a gap that you might need because you're losing time or something. With the Behrmann incident, I feel this is different to the Lawson incident last time out. Last time out was very much a racing incident between Sainz and Lawson. Happy to let that one go. This one, he knew that Behrmann was there. Behrmann had more than enough of his car alongside, not necessarily front wheel to front wheel or front wing to front wheel, as the rules for some reason state that's the dividing thing. But there is
But
also
plenty, if you turn and look, you can see him.
yes, if you turn and look, you can see him. You know he's there because you've been scrapping with him for the last lap or so. And also, turn four is broad enough across its width that you can get two cars around the outside. Because also at that
We
point,
saw that with McLaren last year when Oscar got past Lando.
You can go too wide through that section quite happily, and the battle continues running down towards the Lesmos. And then it's a different thing of who's got the balls to hang around the outside of one of the faster corners. And then it becomes interesting, and you get this great race. Whereas for some reason, Sainz just turned in on him. I don't get it. That's not something you expect from someone that's that experienced and that talented and has such a good sort of roster of achievements prior to this season. And I think Behrmann was right to try and make that move and force Sainz into it because ultimately, Behrmann either has to get on the brakes, get out of it, loses a lot, or Sainz just cuts across turn four because, as we later found, that's something you
Yeah,
do.
there's no reason why he shouldn't have done that either.
Like, I think that would have been perfectly fine. As Sainz looked to his mirror, know that he's been sort of forced into an error. Potentially, Behrmann gets at that point a 5 second penalty for forcing another driver off track, which is a bit more reasonable than for some reason a 10 second penalty and 2 penalty points. This now puts Behrmann on 10 across a 12 month span. Any more,
Magnussen.
we're going to have to bring back Magnussen to swap him in. It's going to be like the
Well,
Vikes
can you imagine Hulk gets called in back to Haas as their reserve, and then Magnussen goes over to race to kick Sauber? You go, what on earth is happening?
What on earth is happening? It's baffling, and I don't understand the stewards' decisions for it. I don't think that because we've got this sort of if you're ahead at the apex or if you're significantly alongside at the apex, you're entitled to your corner. It's sort of left this gray area of that looks significantly alongside enough for anyone who's got an ounce of common sense. And then all of a sudden it sort of goes horribly wrong. And I think this was entirely on Carlos, not Behrmann. And it was messy. It was a very, very messy weekend from Sainz, especially considering it started so well. We saw him in the top three in one of the practice sessions. The Williams pace early on, they just seemed to somehow lose it and failed to capitalize on it as the weekend went by, as the track sort of warmed up, as the track got grippier as well. We saw that evolution, and the car just got worse for him. The curious case of Carlos Sainz rumbles on, because I don't know what's got him so rattled and what's caused this sort of seeming loss of racecraft. It's baffling. But we'll move to Aston Martin, where business as usual for Lance Stroll, qualified 17th, finished 18th. Fernando Alonso, though, qualified 8th and DNF'd after a suspension failure, which was a very odd one. But as soon as I saw him come round this car chicane, I was like, oh, suspension's gone. And everyone was going, oh, I think he's
So
got
when you got
a tyre. Look at.
the replay, you could tell immediately. It's like, oh yeah, no, that's not good.
Yeah, everyone's sort of, you heard on the commentary, I think Crofty was like, oh, I think he's got a rear right puncture. I was like, front suspension's gone. I was like, come on, Crofty, you should know this by now. But yeah, odd one. They were waiting for the right safety car strategy for Stroll, and it just didn't pay out, I think.
This is the one time, and it happens about once a season, so this is the time for it where you can give Stroll the benefit of the doubt there, because he was running in the top 10 for the majority of the Grand Prix and was just hanging it out. And it was worth the risk at Monza in what was just then an uncharacteristically safety car free race. So on paper, yeah, business as usual for Stroll, but with a slight caveat for a change of going, I'll give him that one. Everyone gets one for three, and that's your one. But yeah, Alonso, disappointing. He was having a great scrap with Bortoleto up to that point as well. So yeah, we're seeing interestingly more reliability issues coming into play this season than perhaps we'd have thought, and I wonder why we're seeing that. It's not just Mercedes, we're seeing a little bit from everyone, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it's Alonso's performance was really good. Stroll's was pretty good as well. I think they've just sort of come to a strong point in their season. They've finally got the car sort of nailed down under them, and just going to be sort of trying to capitalize on what they've got left. When it comes to their sort of championship battle, they're still a fair way adrift of Williams, essentially. They're sort of over, I think they're about over 20, 24 points adrift, and sort of entangled now with RB, who are just a point behind them. It's very close down that end of the field. And yeah, I think actually I've forgot to mention this weekend, Alex Albon, a very strong performance that now moves him also ahead of Kimi Antonelli in the drivers'
Yes,
standings,
I was
before we
going
can
to mention that
move
as
on to him
well.
too quickly, which is sort of a damning indictment for Antonelli's season, and a great one for Alex Albon's, because that sort of.
Strengthens the conversation we were having last week about if you're looking at who to put in that Mercedes seat for next year, if the contracts aren't signed, are you having that conversation with Albon?
Yeah, I mean, you might do, because that puts him, what, seventh now in the standings, and what's his best season finish? I dare I ask?
I
Alex.
dare say he's never finished ahead of Mercedes before.
I don't think he's ever finished ahead of Mercedes. His best finish in Formula One was 2020, when he finished seventh.
And that was in the Renault.
With 105 points as well. So there's a very real chance that Albon, as it goes, he's got another
How
what's
many points has he got?
he's on 70.
That's doable.
That's doable. It's another 35 points, which how many races have we got left to do?
Eight.
Yeah.
It's
One,
doable.
three, four, five, six, seven, 8 points. 8 points spread over 35 points spread over eight is less than seven to go or something. 35 divided by
Also,
eight.
just P7, P8 every race. And even if he doesn't finish in one and just gets an absolute bowser of a P4 or a P5 in one of them, done.
What, 4 1/3 points? So all he's got to do basically is just come home. What's four? What gets you 4 points or 6 points? Fifth.
Seventh and eighth, I think,
Seventh and
isn't it?
eighth, yeah, he's got to come home basically seventh every weekend, I think, which isn't too shabby. So just check the notes so we can
That'd
accurately.
be a great way to get back at Red Bull for dropping him in the first place. Go and look what I've just done on Williams. Where's
Yeah,
your driver?
if he finishes seventh in every race from here to the end, he will not only have his strongest points finish ever, he'll tie for his strongest position finish ever, and putting him on around that 105 mark would put him, I think he might give him a chance to sort of chase down possibly Lewis if Lewis has another couple of bad races, which would be
I don't
baffling.
think we're going to go that far, but
Lewis is on 117. It's not out of reason that if Albon.
no, but at the same time, I don't see that.
We'll see how it pans out. Anyway, back to Aston Martin, because there's just not a lot to say about Aston Martin, I feel, at this point in time. They're just sort of getting on with their season and just sort of Fernando Alonso's starting to feel a bit like Victor Martin's in F2. If he didn't have bad luck, he'd have no luck at all. And
So I'm used to seeing Victor Martins more outside the car than in it this year. It's really quite sad.
yeah, he might as well just become a pit lane reporter the amount of time he spends stood in it these days. But yeah,
The silver lining for his weekend is the great story that Brundle was saying during commentary. I don't know if you heard about how he and Bortoleto were on scooters going through the paddock and shoving each other into the Ferrari's motorhome.
Yes,
Just going, yeah, that's fun. I like the relationship those two have got.
they've got a good working relationship, and yeah, obviously Bortoleto are part of Alonso's talent management pool. We'll move then on to Kick Sauber. Hülkenberg qualified 12th and wouldn't start due to a hydraulic failure, I believe it was, and then Bortoleto qualified 7th and finished 8th, which, considering rookie season, this is another strong outing from Bortoleto.
Yeah, great stuff again. We're one crazy race away from him being on the podium. And when you look at the Grand Prix that we've got coming up, Baku's overdue for a crazy race. Singapore could be a bit crazy. Brazil would be perfect. Las Vegas could happen. Qatar, it was the only good race that that team had last year. You never know. They're all contenders for that. And the fact that there's more Grand Prix where it could happen than not is a good omen, I think. Hülkenberg, yeah. Shit happens, really, doesn't it? But Crofty was saying it's his first DNF of the season. Like, it's literally not. He didn't start. That's the whole point of him going in now. So he still technically has a perfect record of no DNFs this season.
He didn't take the starting lights, therefore he did not start. An interesting one on Bortoleto, obviously Sauber driver in his rookie season. Charles Leclerc in his rookie season at Sauber, 39 points, came home 13th. Bortoleto, as it stands, is 16th. So it's not unreasonable, but he's got to get past Lawson, who's on 20 points. So he's got to get another 2 points to get past Lawson. 16th place is held. No, he's in 16th. 15th is Lawson. 14th is Gasly. So yeah, if he gets another 2 points, he's getting up there to essentially have a tied rookie season with Charles Leclerc. And look at what Charles has gone on to do. So it's a good one from Bortoleto, really. And he's got some brilliant racecraft that's really coming to show at the moment as well, because he's sort of fighting one hand tied behind his back. The Sauber is decent, but compared to the cars, it often finds itself scrapping away with every now and then Max Verstappen in a Red Bull.
Seventh or eighth is going to be the highest you can get, barring something crazy happening. So I think you can be pretty happy with that.
Yeah, we have like a wet coater or something, and there's going to be something magical that potentially happens
We
there.
ever had a wet coater?
I don't think we have. Well, we know we
Don't
did.
think we have.
We did this weekend, if you were watching Lone Star.
Yes, but in
In
Formula One.
Formula One, we haven't, but there we go. We'll move on from Sauber to Racing Bulls. Lawson qualified 19th, finished 14th. Isaac Hadjar qualified 20th, started from the pit lane, finished in the points. Well, in the point.
Just the one point, actually. But yeah, it was worth trying things with Lawson after qualifying just didn't go to plan. And I think in any other year at Monza, it would have worked, thanks to the craziness that usually comes that way. But not this time. And yeah, softs coming in early and then switching. And yeah, it was messy. But I don't think you can do too much with that. At the same time, that Hadjar, well, he had the benefit of not being on that strategy, so he was on this other kind of Hail Mary strategy, but it was the Hail Mary that would work. Brilliant recovery, and that one point will be a nice silver lining for him after being knocked out of Q1 for the first time in his career. He was not a happy bunny, and I was getting flashbacks to last year.
Unhappy Isaac Hadjar at Monza. Tinfoil hat time. Did he get knocked out of Q1, or did he knock himself out of Q1 to try and avoid this sort of alluring eye of Helmut Marko, trying to sort of beckon him towards the Red Bull, just going, see, no, I've still got foibles. I still need to spend another season here learning. Leave me alone.
I think if that was what he was trying to do, then he shouldn't have finished in the points.
Yeah, he shouldn't have gone a pit
So
lane to
much ahead of
finish.
Yuki.
Yeah, he shouldn't have.
Ha ha! Damn, I've bollocks, I've got a point. Shit. Right.
This is my petard. I appear to have been hoisted by it. Yeah, 6.5 does the other when it comes to Hajar, but in a great sense. Yeah, Racing Bulls again, not a great deal to say. Haas, not really a lot to say here. We've already discussed that 10-second penalty for Behrmann, really, when we talk about Williams. Ocon qualified 15th, finished 15th. Behrmann qualified 11th, finished 12th. And I think Ocon, quiet race, not a great deal happening for him. I don't think we really saw him on screen. But when it came to Behrmann, jousty, fighty, punchy. We're still seeing a lot from this guy as he's working his way through his rookie season, and it's impressive. But I think, unfortunately, this time the basically stewards rolled a dice and it didn't roll his way.
Yeah, I won't go over it again. It's just a ridiculous penalty for him. But he wasn't the only one of the team that had a bit of a nonsense penalty because Ocon got one of those as well early on in the race. And yeah, I don't know what that was about really. So for him, it was worth again a little bit like Stroll hanging him out until the very end to see if they could take advantage of anything. He was running comfortably inside the top 10, and had it not been for that meddling penalty, he would have got some points on the board, and you'd have been looking at Ocon with P7 or whatever next to his name, going, "How the hell have you managed to do that again?" But sadly, not the case. But worth a try.
Yeah, it's a bit odd that Haas's current strategy just seems to be a case of go for some Hail Marys and see
I
what
like it
happens.
though, because it's what a team like that needs to do when they aren't capable of doing more than that. They need to go, "Well, what's the worst that happens? We're going to be exactly where we would be otherwise, so why not?"
Yeah, we'll try
What
and
they are allowed to roll the
strategy.
dice because that works fine. Stewards, no, you've got a rule book, follow it.
Yeah, I think that's possibly the best way of laying out that law. And then finally, we get to Alpine. Gasly qualified 11th, finished 16th, and Colapinto qualified 17th, finished 17th.
I think for me, the only thing I've got to say here, aside from the lovely livery that they have, is Brundle's comment on not often seeing someone lock up the rear tyres after Colapinto did that on turn one before his stop was quite amusing, because Martin Brundle has been around for a little bit of time now, and the fact that he can still see brand new things that he's never seen before after so many years is a beautiful thing. It's just a shame it's that.
It's credit to Colapinto for trying something new. Yeah, I
One
don't
way of looking at it. You're
I don't
looking for a job in PR without being.
I don't really have a great deal to say about what Alpine did this weekend, because they might as well have not been there for all it seems to have really mattered. And I think that's possibly the most cutting that you could really have it as a statement. Everyone else got involved in the race at some point. They had like altercations or incidents or battle moments with different drivers and different teams and sort of cause shuffles and
It's
everything like
something
that.
we can talk about, whereas the most we've got for them is Colapinto locked up a tyre.
Alpine, if you subtract them from the equation, nothing else, nothing changes, which is odd. I will say, however, I haven't found another way of slotting this in, but I don't know if you were noticed at the sort of introductory commentary for the Formula 2 feature race. Was a welcome to Colton Herta fans. This is what you've got to look forward to. I'm like, that hasn't been confirmed yet. What do you know?
Oh, it's everything except confirmed. We know it's happening.
Which I thought was very interesting. I was like, I remember watching it back after that, watching because I missed the F2 and F3 because I had a bit of a lying, so I was incredibly hungover from the night before. So I was watching the F2 back and I went, hang on, that's.
Did I hear that right, or am I imagining things?
Play that back. Play that back. But anyway, we'll move on from that weird aside to winners and spinners. And Timo, we'll start with your winner, please.
I had a couple options for this, but I thought I'd go for the easy route one option of Max Verstappen. The fact that he didn't think he was going to win another Grand Prix this year after Imola, but everyone else was like, "We won't be surprised if you do." And then for him to not only do so at Monza, comfortably beating both McLarens by 20 odd seconds, it's a nice statement. And Brundle summed it perfectly as well on the commentary when they were showing the podium. Like, you can tell that these wins are meaning a lot to him, maybe more than a lot of his other ones are. Because he's not used to winning now at that point, which he's gone. He's I don't I hesitate to say he's peaked, because I don't think he has in terms of his driving his racecraft, but maybe in terms of his winning streak. I'd say that we might be over that crest. So he's still very capable of it, but it's not going to happen to the frequency with which it's been done over the last number of years. So when he does manage to do it now and he gets the opportunity and it delivers and he has a pretty perfect weekend, as we saw, it means that bit extra. And yeah, it's weird for me to now be kind of pumping the air when he gets past the McLaren and going, hey, this is what we want to see. And I'm like, the fuck is wrong with me?
Yeah,
Why am I doing
what's
this?
changed? Yeah. That's a it's an interesting way of just looking at that Verstappen thing, because you're like, I don't previous years I wouldn't have sort of wouldn't have been so emotive about Verstappen winning the Italian Grand Prix. But it also means he's weirdly done the Italian double this season. I don't know if you caught that when he sort of congratulated him. Because obviously Max's last win was also Imola. So like perhaps that those that this is gonna be like his weird little thing
And
going
it's an
on.
interesting mix of tracks that he's won at this year. Three wins. It's Japan, Imola, and Monza. And you go, that's it's a little bit like Carlos Sainz's win record. You're going, I don't mind the combination, but it's an interesting combination when you trace it
Yeah,
through where
I don't
he's
know
been victorious.
how you've got all of these ones to be like the ones that you somehow won at. But again, that usually shows sort of good breadth in the driver. For me, my winner, Isaac Hadjar, pit lane to the
V10.
points in an RB is pretty good, I gotta say. Obviously, he had a bit of strategy really helping him along with that, but ultimately you've still got to drive it, you've still got to make it work, you've still got to stay clear and make those passes on track as well. So for me, yeah, Isaac Hadjar, back-to-back winner in my mind. Spinners, I'm perplexed by this choice. Tell me more.
I'm perplexed by this choice initially, but then I thought about it and I stick with it. I've chosen Oscar Piastri as my spinner purely for letting Lando get past without any kind of a fight, and then not really going after him by the looks of things. I think the blame should lie solely with the team. Maybe a little bit with Lando because he is the one that decided to pull the trigger and go, I don't want to go first. You decide. But principally the team. But at the same time, Oscar didn't then need to let him go by. He should have just gone, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. Sometimes that's racing. If he wants to go past, he can come and overtake me himself. I'm not going to pull over and let it happen. And I think that's the first proper mistake he's made since Melbourne when he went spinning off the track. And I'm not a fan of that. And it doesn't happen too often. So I'm criticizing him for it and I'm putting him in the bin for that one. So Oscar Piastri is my spinner.
Fair enough. I think if I'm going to go for a spinner, obvious one, Carlos Sainz. I don't know where that move came from. It's the sort of thing you'd expect from a really terrible rookie. It's
I was going to say from a rookie.
Mazepin is what it is. You'd expect it.
I don't know if we're going that harsh with him. That's a bit, but I know what you. I know what you're getting. It
It's
is. It's sort of a. It's a
careless and
Sargent.
clumsy.
It's a DeFreeze. It's a. You
Yeah,
know.
it's
It's that
careless.
sort of a thing.
Yeah, careless, clumsy. It's
Ambitious but rubbish.
yeah, and you should know better if you're Carlos Sainz. How long has he been in the sport now? He should have,
2015, a decade.
yeah, he should have a far better sort of understanding of not necessarily closing the door on someone, because it is also just going to spin you around as well. Meanwhile, speaking of ambitious but rubbish, our predictions review. No
We did
points.
really well this week.
No, none of us, neither of us got points, which is great news for Annie May, who also technically gets no points, having made no predictions. So, with zero effort, she's
It's
just.
a draw between the three of us this week. That's what's
Yes.
happened.
Yeah, that's the way this has panned out. And then we get to our fantasy Formula One review for Monza. LeVictory comes out on top, 221 points. Carlos Williams, Zeegan, 215. New entry there, or possibly a renaming. And Lando, 205. Catherine's Curse and On the Curbs in P9. The Cat Dad's P22. The Mixing Pot, P27. The Dog Dad's P61. Jaffa Cake Racing, P62. Jesus, what did I do there?
Yeah,
And Kiwi Burners, P63. What did I.
I was scrolling through because when I do these, I look for the highest placed teams for the three of us, and then if there's anyone that we know that is doing well, like Catherine, for example, is doing brilliantly this year, and I was going down like Jesus, where is everyone else? I thought I'd had a terrible weekend because I'd had Hülkenberg, I had Alonso on double points in one of my teams, and I'm like, surely you two must have got ahead of me, and then I'm finding you lot down in the P60s. I'm like, what on earth have you done?
Oh, I'll tell you what I did. So for Jaffa Cake Racing, Charles Leclerc on a double, 42 points, not bad. George Russell, 19 points, not bad. Racing Bulls, 27 points, take that. Haas, 7 points. Pretty good. Esteban Ocon, 1 point. Fernando Alonso, minus 15 points. Nico Hülkenberg, minus 20
Nico. That'll do it. There goes your Charles Leclerc points immediately before you even get to the rest of them.
That was not a good one. Meanwhile, overall, Deticlias 3,090 points. LeVictory, 3,090 points. Tied at the top. Lando in third place, 2,933 points. Catherine's Curse, P4. On the Curbs, P9. Can't Grow Moustache, P11. The Mixing Pot, P18. Red Bull Rejects, P62. And Kiwi Burners, P63. That's...
Where else would they be?
That's all for this episode of the Undercut Podcast. We'll be back soon for a preview of the Azerbaijan Grand Prix. In the meantime, though, Timo, where can you be found?
This week, you can find me over on the Curve Instagram, where I've got an interview out with Italian racing driver Valentina Pessini, and I've got a new episode of On the Curve, the podcast, out with FIM Women's Pivotal Ability. So go and check those out.
Brilliant stuff. And if you want more from me, you can find me online as at Jesse on Cars on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And you can, of course, find me writing for Classic Car Weekly and on the Classic Car Weekly podcast. Worth giving those. Certainly picking up the latter. The new issue's out on Wednesday. It'll be out when we're recording our Baku Grand Prix preview. And that's got the stories from my... No, not Wednesday. We've got a gap, haven't we? I forgot we're not going back-to-back-to-back. We've still got a little bit of a gap to come. But yeah, pick up the latest one. That'll be out on Wednesday. It's got my stories of ragging a Suzuki Jimny around Corfu. Otherwise, that's all we've got time for this week. We'll be back soon-ish, probably, I'm informed, for a preview of the Azerbaijan Grand Prix.